This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, November 1st. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. He's speaking with Catherine Shen of Connecticut Public. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle will check in with us. We'll hear from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. We'll have State House correspondent Katie Lannon on the program, and we'll hear from CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. A federal auction this week determined which offshore wind developers will have the right to pursue wind farms off the Outer Cape, but only half of the leases sold, and there wasn't much competition. CAI reporter Jeanette Barnes is here to talk about that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
We have been reporting that this auction was coming up. Leases on 8 offshore wind areas were up for bid. The auction was Tuesday. First, tell us what happened and who were the winners.
Sure. Well, the first thing to know about this auction of these wind leases is that out of the eight areas, only 4 actually received bids. So, as you said, half of them were sold. There were 2 bidders. One was Avangrid, which is already a 50-50 partner in Vineyard Wind and has some other projects in the works. And the second bidder is a Chicago-based company called Invenergy. I did request an interview with them. They were not able to do it right away, but their website says that they have offshore wind leases right now off New Jersey and California. So one thing that's notable about this auction and about them is they're headquartered in the U.S., which is not the case for many of the parent companies of other offshore wind developers that have been involved in the New England market. So 2 winners, each of them bid on 2 wind areas, but not the same ones. So in other words, for each area that sold, it only got 1 bid. Each area only got 1 bid. There was no competition within those individual wind areas. There wasn't even a second round of bidding. Let's compare this to 2018 for a second. That was when the lower part of the wind areas south of the islands were auctioned off. In that situation, there were 32 rounds of bidding. And at that time, the average price was more than $1,000 an acre. This time, of course, since it was round 1, the bidders started at the minimum $50 per acre. And so that was the sale price, $50 per acre.
It's a lot different than the way we've been seeing wind farm leases go. These leases don't mean that the developers can build. They have a long process ahead of them. Explain what that process looks like and what the timeline looks like.
Sure. Yes, it is definitely a years-long, if not decades-long process. In some cases, obviously, they have a lot of steps to go through. For off the Cape, they need a detailed plan. They have to get financing. There's a federal environmental review. There's permitting. They also have to arrange for the onshore transmission of the power. And then last but not least, or maybe not exactly last, but they have to secure a buyer for the power, which typically for the developments, wind developments we've seen so far off the islands, that involves bidding into a state procurement process. So all of that would still have to happen. I talked to Ken Kimmel of Avangrid this week. He is the chief development officer. He says their projects off the Outer Cape probably wouldn't be built until the 2040s. They and some other developers have other projects that are already started that they're working on as well. But clearly, these 2 companies that bid this week, they wanted to secure those leases for the future, for when they are ready to use them. Kimmel says that carrying that lease year to year before they build is actually not that expensive.
The price for the leases that these companies paid, remind us what this is? It was between like $4.9 million and $6.2 million each of the leases.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it was. Yes. So that it adds up fast when you have that many acres. I think the smallest one was about 97,000 acres. Mm. And then they go up well over 100,000 acres in the 120s. So, yes, the total prices at that $50 per acre were in the neighborhood neighborhood of 4.9 to 6-ish million.
And thinking about construction, Avangrid saying that they're looking at 2040, so that's a good way off still. I know you're doing some more reporting on what these auction results kind of could signal for the industry as a whole. What are you hearing so far?
Well, yeah, I wanted to find out what they had to say about the state of the industry with just two bidders for all of these areas and all of what, Kimmel says is so much economic opportunity out there. He says he was surprised that there were only two bidders, but he wouldn't read too much into it in terms of the future. He's saying all of this is a long-term proposition, and most likely, if it follows suit from the past, the other areas off the Cape will be auctioned at some point in the future, in a future lease sale. Kimmel of Avangrid also looked at what New England is projected to need by 2050 in terms of offshore wind power, and that number is 34 gigawatts. He says the areas in the leases in the shallow areas, like off the islands, will only generate about 10 gigawatts in New England. So again, he sees that as a big opportunity, and that's what they're counting on for the future. I also wanted to get some reaction from the mayor of New Bedford, John Mitchell, to see what he thought about just having two bidders, because he has been, a really big advocate of offshore wind and bringing the jobs here. He says that, yes, it reflects a lot of uncertainty in the offshore wind industry right now, especially about the election. He says, if Donald Trump becomes president, that could mean 4 years at least of policies that discourage offshore wind, at a minimum, discourage it. I mean, at one point, Trump actually said he would stop offshore wind on day one. So, of course, that's going to give developers pause, and that was what Mitchell pointed to as a major factor.
Speaking of New Bedford, I know that you also asked Mayor Mitchell about a perhaps surprising bit of information in that latest jobs report from Vineyard Wind. Tell us about that.
Yes, yeah, so we first talked about this data on the News Roundup last week, and it was Vineyard Wind had released some jobs numbers at the Offshore Wind Conference in New Bedford last week. And the company representative from Vineyard Offshore said that when Vineyard Wind counts the number of local people that they are employing on the project, they track it by the zip code the person had after they moved here to do the work, even if it's more or less a temporary employee who comes here for a few months and stays in a hotel. So again, since Mitchell's been such a big advocate of the wind jobs, I wanted to see what he would say about that. And he says he feels Vineyard Wind needs to try harder. He says the city appreciates the economic activity that's being generated by people just staying in the city to work, paying rent or paying a hotel, eating all of that. But he also wants to understand how many actual New Bedford residents are getting this work. A lot of the Americans who have the most experience with offshore work are people who've worked on oil and gas rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. So that is one reason that it's conceivable that some people who are being recorded as local residents are not really from Massachusetts.
You were in New Bedford this week for some election reporting. The mayor and the police chief are talking about security issues on election day. Are there particular concerns around that? Let's talk about the election coming up.
Sure, yeah. Well, they said there are no threats against the election in New Bedford. So they did want to kind of clear up that was not the reason that they were drawing attention to this issue. But Mayor Mitchell did say anxiety's running high in the country now about the election, and he wanted to reassure the public both about public safety on election day and also about election integrity, like the security of the ballots and the voting system. He says, he's been in office almost 13 years, and this was the first time he felt like he needed to hold a press conference prior to the election to talk about these security issues. He had the police chief with him there as well, and some others. They say they're going to have police at every polling place all day, which is actually not that unusual. But the city is also planning to have some plainclothes officers around. They have done extra training for some of their election workers and police around some of these security issues. They even had, he said, a training for delivery drivers who deliver the ballots to the polling stations for the city, because they have over two dozen polling places. So they've done any whatever review they needed on that. And the city has purchased some new tabulating machines. One model they bought can read 72 ballots a minute. So they're saying their technology is up to snuff as well. And they're going to have extra people working in the city solicitor's office on election day too, in case any questions of legality arise at the polling places. They can address those in real time.
A lot going on there to make sure that it is a safe and secure election day. That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
More election news now. This week, early voting continued, and CAI's Eve Zukov drove across the region to check out what was happening at the polls. She joins us right now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
First off, give us a sense of where you went on your day talking with voters.
Sure. So I drove around the mid-Cape into the lower Cape. It was a good opportunity to check out the many, many, many political signs that are all over our roadways. It feels like more than previous years, some voters told me. I can't get a perfect count on that. But yeah, I went from Falmouth to Mashpee to Barnstable to Yarmouth, and then ended the day in Harwich. Apologies to our friends on the South Coast, Outer Cape and Islands, but we tried to cover as much ground as we could in a day.
And I know that you talked to, along the way, you talked to voters of all stripes, Democrats, Republicans. What did you hear? What kinds of issues guided the ballot decisions that people were making?
Yeah, so the Democrats that I spoke with cited their vote had to do with abortion, for example. There was an older woman that I spoke with who said she grew up in an era where, hangers were used for back alley abortions. And so it's really important to her to have a president that supports access to safe, legal abortions. Another woman brought up immigration. She doesn't like Trump's policies on immigration. Another man I spoke with just said, I don't like the craziness of Trump of the 4 years. It felt like there was always something, is what he said. Of the Republicans I talked to, kind of on the flip side, I talked to someone who said he didn't like the last 4 years of leadership, and he was just kind of voting against that. And then another woman brought up concerns about the economy for why her vote was going to the Trump Vance campaign. She said the prices of everything is just so high, groceries. But, you know, people will remember there are five statewide ballot questions and one more for Barnstable County voters. The statewide questions have to do with MCAS and restaurant tipping slash like minimum wage for waiters, psychedelics. And one woman said she was actually more focused on these.
What was the mood like for people who had cast their ballots?
It was the full range. I saw some people who were just incredibly casual about it. They were glad to get this done, back to work. And then I saw others, like these two older women. They were in their 80s or 90s. They voted together. I watched them go into the building, and then they came out and they jumped up and down together a little bit once they hit the street. And they were talking about what a great service it felt like to vote. I also talked with a woman in Harwich who actually broke down in tears because she said she has been incredibly anxious, and that this moment to vote was her moment to do something, and suddenly it was over, and now she just needs to wait, which is so difficult. And I know actually election anxiety is something that The Point, our show from 9 to 10 here on CAI, is going to be taking on Tuesday.
How about town clerks? When you talk about anxiety, they're really the core election officials across the region. Did you speak with town clerks?
Yeah, it was interesting to hear what Jeanette was talking about. You know, first of all, I'll say these people are professionals. Many have been working elections in their towns for decades. Like Mashpee, the town clerk, is approaching 30 years, retiring soon. But that's not to say there was no anxiety, even for the pros. You know, in Yarmouth, the town clerk talked to me about the level of misinformation she's been hearing. People are coming up to her and asking about, you know, what happens if someone casts, you know, two ballots under the same name? And she said, like, that will not. We are handling this with the utmost care. We have so many checks and balances set up to make sure that that kind of thing does not happen. But you know, I noted to her there was a police officer who was on duty in the kind of room where people were casting their ballots. And she said, look, because of the location of the room, because, as Jeanette was talking about, of the mood of this election, this town clerk said there are many entrances to the room. We want to ensure that the ballots are protected and that our election workers are protected. So people, I think, should expect to see police officers at their polling place this year.
I have just about a minute here, but I want to ask you about one more story, which is almost not a story, but is a big story kind of at the same time.
Yes.
And that is the Massachusetts Army National Guard and the Environmental Protection Agency met this week. We know to talk through maybe, I don't know, some of their differences. They were in the same room, we think, at the same time, but there's not a lot we know about this. This has to do with the machine gun range and these two agencies just being absolutely at odds about whether this should ever exist.
Yeah, these two have had a complete breakdown of their relationship. We know this from internal emails sent that have been exposed for us. I wish I could tell you more about the event this week. I mean, it was a closed meeting between the EPA and the Guard and a bunch of scientists. But, you know, we think that what they talked about was kind of all the things they disagree about when it comes to potential impacts of the machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod, of the proposed machine gun range. The Guard says the range wouldn't contaminate the aquifer that the range sits above. That is important because the aquifer provides us with drinking water on the Upper Cape and even into the Mid Cape. But the EPA hasn't agreed and has a ton of power here. If the EPA concludes in what's called a sole source aquifer review that the range would pose a risk to public health, the EPA can basically ensure that future federal funding for the range, which has already been kind of all but killed here, basically disappears. It's kind of a final nail in the coffin. So this week they were trying to maybe iron out their differences around the science.
But nobody was talking. Publicly.
You know, as reporters, this is not enough transparency for me to feel all that good about it. I will hopefully bring you some information on it, but we'll see.
CAI's Eve Zukoff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Last Friday, staff at CAI learned that our parent company, GBH, is selling the building that we broadcast from here in Woods Hole. It's an historic building that has been the station's home since CAI first went on the air in 2000. GBH has told CAI staff not to comment publicly on this move. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times reported this story for his paper. Since I'm not permitted to comment, I asked Catherine Shen of Connecticut Public Radio to talk to Sam about the story. Here's their conversation.
So, Sam, this announcement seems to have come as a pretty big surprise to the station staff on Cape Cod. What is GBH saying about the reasons behind this sale?
Yeah, so they kind of released a statement to me saying that the station is operating at a deficit. Much like many, you know, radio shows and newspapers around the country, and basically saying that this would be done as a money saver, that with the sale, the profit of the sale of the building, they could support kind of their journalism going forward. And that was kind of the extent of their comment. I guess also they were saying that they'll be looking for a new location, but otherwise, right, saying that they are at a deficit with this location and the proceeds of the sale are going to support kind of their efforts going forward.
And do you have any idea if GBH involves CAI in the decision-making process?
Right, yeah. So we spoke with Jay Allison, who is the founder of CAI, also the founder of many programs listeners know, The Moth and
right.
things like that. And what he told me was, no, they really got caught by surprise by this.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I think his point that he wanted to make is, had they been warned and given some heads up, they might have tried to reach a different agreement, maybe go out to the community and say, we're facing this problem. Could we come up with some kind of solution? And yeah, I was somewhat surprised how candid he was with me, saying, you know, he's really disappointed that and it's also saying this is a kind of a bad decision in that having to rent a space another place, they're just going to incur more and more costs. So he was very surprised by it. I think saddened is a good way to put it as well. This is such an important building, he says, for the station, that you can kind of, I thought interesting, you know, it's a historic building. You can kind of, there are intangibles there that you can't necessarily describe,
right.
But that translates to going on air.
Well, and then with that in mind, too, like you mentioned, you were surprised at how candid he was. You know, what else did he tell you about? You know, it sounds like he has a lot of strong feelings about this decision.
Well, right. I mean, I think there was a lot of big community effort, you know, not just the radio station, but in the community as well in Falmouth and Woodsole to get the money to buy the facility. And, you know, I think with that, you know, I guess, you know, the feeling is that this is beyond just the radio stations. There's really community buy-in.
Right.
And so it's more than just, you know, the radio station, I guess, that the community is going to feel this impact as well. And, I should say, you know, full transparency, I did work at CAI 2 years ago, and I also grew up in Woodsole. And, you know, there is, you know, that's a really special area. Water Street, you know, there's science institutions there. There's a library there. You know, my favorite spot, Pie in the Sky, right across the street. But, right. You know, it has this really special feel to that area.
Sure.
And I think one of their goals in picking that location is you have that, but you also are really close to the ferry that goes to Martha's Vineyard. And it's kind of a hub that allows them to kind of be in touch with the community that they report on.
Well, and I do want to get back to sort of, yeah, like the feelings that you're talking about in terms of it being such a community space and so much history with it. And you've also touched on this a little bit earlier, too. But, you know, talk about this decision fitting into some of the bigger shakeups within public media, as we've talked about. You know, this is a tough time for local media.
Right. I think Jay spoke to this, too. He understands the decision. And I think, you know, any of us that are reporting at local papers or on the radio can feel, you know, I don't know the stat, but there are papers closing every, you know, few weeks or days even. And people are looking to make cuts where they can to save money. And obviously, that's such a prime location. You can make a lot of money. So in that building, it's sad. It's unfortunate that, you know, these institutions are really having a hard time. And GBH, you know, one of the biggest in the game, to see them struggling, it's too bad. And, you know, I work at a small paper on the Vineyard. We've had our struggles, but, we're pushing through. But, you know, you can't help but feel kind of camaraderie
sure.
in a way with other institutions that are struggling as well.
No, absolutely. I was a newspaper reporter before as well, so I feel that pain very hard. And one thing you mentioned earlier, too, you know, there's this possibility of finding a new location. Do you have any word on where that new location might be?
No, no, GBH hasn't said anything. That'd be too much to speculate on where they might go. But I think it would be somewhere where they have less of an upkeep at that facility. And,
sure.
You know, maybe not the same high-profile location.
Well, and then one more thing here, because this story has been getting a lot of attention, a lot of comments on the website. And what have you been hearing from people in the station's listening area?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think right now people are surprised that this is happening. I would say, you know, on the Vineyard, I haven't heard a ton. Folks are, I guess, a little upset that they feel like GBH did this quietly. I think there's some upset, you know, folks upset about that. But I know in the Woodsole community, it's such an important area, historic area, that some are frustrated that might go to, I don't know who, but it could be a private developer. And I think there's a lot of speculation of,
sure.
of what's going to happen with that building.
Stan Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that was Catherine Shen of Connecticut Public with the news that CAI Station Home is being sold by GBH, its parent company, without prior warning to CAI staff. Thanks to Catherine and Sam Houghton for reporting that. CAI staff have been directed not to comment publicly. You can find this story on our website, capeandislands.org, where you'll also find a link to a story on this by the Boston Globe. Deep breath. And onward, Monomoy Regional Middle School is going to need some expensive work to keep its structure healthy. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to explain. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, architects hired to evaluate the building say it needs new siding and it will be a costly endeavor. Explain what's happening.
So the Monomoy Middle School was originally was Chatham High School, and it became the regional middle school when Chatham and Harwich merged into the Monomoy District. In 1997, when it was Chatham High School, the building was completely renovated, and apparently it wasn't done as well as would have been hoped. And recently, there have been some issues with the siding and apparent water infiltration into the building. And a consultant hired has found all sorts of problems that they trace back to that original construction in 1997. And they are projecting that replacement of the siding and trim on the building is going to cost about $6.3 million going forward.
That's $6.3 million to replace just the siding and trim. Where is that going to come from now?
Well, the Monomoy, Harwich and Chatham will have to decide whether or not they'll approve this money at the town meeting in May. Now, the school district has the ability to bond a large expense like this, and the cost would be distributed over 20 years probably, and both towns would absorb it into the tax rate. The problem here is one of sort of oversight as far as we've been able to determine. The superintendent of schools, Scott Carpenter, said that back in 97 when the original work was done, there was no owner's project manager. That kind of wasn't a thing back then. It's only come into being in the last maybe decade or so, where large town projects require sort of oversight by an independent manager. And I think it's actually required by law for projects over a certain amount of money these days. And, the company that did the work in 97 is out of business. So the towns have no recourse to that. So it looks like the voters will be on the hook for that money. It really is work that needs to be done, because if you look on our website, we've got photos of the trim and the siding on the building, and it's clearly needs to be replaced. And officials say it was sort of reaching the end of its design life anyway, but the problems are much more severe than were initially expected, including, they found rodent droppings inside the trim areas, and places where water has infiltrated and actually rusted some of the steel infrastructure in the interior walls. So it's a major project, and it's something that really has to be done to ensure the integrity of the school.
You can see those photos at the Cape Cod Chronicle website, capecodchronicle.com. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Steve.
If you're heading to the polls and haven't yet heard of ballot question 7, you are not alone. It's only on the ballot in a few specific Cape towns. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
I had not heard of ballot question 7. It's specific to parts of the Cape, and the person who got it put on the ballot doesn't even live here. What is going on?
Yes, it's a kind of a strange story in a way. Question 7 appears only in the 7 lower and outer Cape towns of the 4th Barnstable House District. So that's Provincetown to Harwich, basically. It's a question that has to do with wind power. The signs on the highway that people have been seeing say, vote no, question 7, Save Cape Cod National Seashore. They don't really explain what that means. But a man named John Leonard, who lives in Hingham, is the person who gathered the 200 signatures that are necessary to put a ballot question on the ballot. And he did that only for this Outer Cape, Outer Lower Cape district, because he says that he did it because of its proximity to the proposed wind energy leasing sites in the Gulf of Maine and growing local resistance to offshore wind out here. He claims to be a wind power proponent, and he says he's out to fight out-of-state dark money that is funding anti-offshore wind efforts.
So just to be clear, this is a non-binding question. This is kind of like a polling question almost, as people are being asked to explain and maybe explain some of the language of what he's saying, I guess.
Yes, that's right, Steve. It's a strange feature of Massachusetts election law that anyone can collect 200 signatures and put a non-binding referendum onto the ballot, which is what this is. This question has no legal impact. What it says in this case is it asks, shall the state representative from this district be instructed to vote in favor of legislation that would support the development of wind power, offshore and onshore wind power development in Massachusetts? But it turns out that the legislature has no role really in awarding contracts to developers of offshore wind. So as Julian Sear, our current state senator, who is running for re-election, says, it's kind of a deceptive question, although Sear says he's going to vote yes on it.
Sear has a challenger.
Yes. Yeah, so Sear's Republican challenger is Christopher Lauzon, and he doesn't live in this district. He lives in the 5th district, so he can't vote on it. But he's telling people that they should vote no, and that this thing came out of nowhere, which it kind of did. Lauzon is opposed to offshore wind quite strongly.
You can read all about it in the Provincetown Independent, where this story is, and it's a great story. Thanks for bringing it to us, Ed.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. A historic industrial building on Nantucket by the waterfront is at the center of contention. The utility company National Grid would like to demolish the nearly 100-year-old building. Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current has the story and more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
This is the former electric company building. It's kind of an amazing structure. Describe it for us.
Well, yeah, it's unique for Nantucket and the downtown area, and this is just a large, nearly 100-year-old brick building that once was part of the coal gasification operation for the former Nantucket Electric Company, which was absorbed into National Grid decades ago. This building, you know, has been sitting pretty much empty for years. After the cables connected Nantucket to the mainland and the power plant along the waterfront was shut down. For a number of years, this building housed remediation equipment. They were cleaning up the site, which was heavily contaminated. So they were pumping groundwater up, filtering it. But since that operation ended, this building has been sitting vacant and empty and really deteriorating. And National Grid is seeking permission to tear it down. But a number of preservationists and the Historic District Commission on the island, where they have to go to receive a permission to tear it down, are asking them to preserve it and restore it, saying that this is a very important historical structure for sort of one of the last vestiges of the working waterfront on Nantucket, and conveys a lot of history. So they got pretty much told no when they came to the Historic District Commission earlier this week. And so they're going to come back and with a perhaps an alternative proposal down the line here. But
when you say they were told no, you mean National Grid was told no about tearing the building down?
Correct. The Historic District Commission members were pretty much unanimous in their opposition to granting a demolition permit for the structure. So, you know, the National Grid said this would be really cost prohibitive to restore or move or come up with some sort of other preservation effort, and that it would likely fall on the ratepayers of Nantucket if they ended up having to do something like that, and that it's really in disrepair and a safety hazard for people. So we're going to follow this story and see where it goes, because I think they're at odds about this this building along the waterfront.
It's amazing that it's in such a prime location. I mean, it looks like a building that's fallen into disrepair. It's a brick building, beautiful brick structure, but it is and it's in a prime location. And the question, I guess, is even if you were to restore it, what do you do with it that way, huh?
Right. And this is an area that's been the focus of town planners for a number of years. As we said, it is the site of the old power plant. It is contaminated. And the town and the property owners in the area, including National Grid, Nantucket Island Resorts, have been looking at this area for, you know, over a decade of potential redevelopment. Could it be a parking garage? Could it be some other sort of mixed-use area? But nothing has come to fruition, just given the complexity of trying to get something done with multiple property owners on a site that was contaminated. So it's a puzzle for sure for planners and the property owners.
Let me ask you about another story in the paper this week. The island's transit service will continue offering free bus rides thanks to some money coming from the state. This has been a very successful program so far.
Yeah, this was our regional transit authority, which we call NERTA, runs the WAVE buses, the public transportation around Nantucket. Earlier this year had a state grant to go fare free, and the results were almost immediate. Ridership jumped. It's up 70% since April 1st. And this week we found out that they will be going fare free for all of next year, 2025, thanks to another round of funding from the state, which granted over $30 million to regional transit authorities around Massachusetts to essentially sponsor fare free throughout the state. So Nantucket is part of that, and I think the people at the Nantucket Regional Transit Authority are excited to be able to sustain this real huge jump that they've seen in ridership.
And one of the things they point out here is not only do riders have the benefit that they can hop on and off buses like that without paying a fare, but it's really removing traffic from, like, when they look at the numbers of riders that have gone to using the system since this program went into effect, it's removing a lot of traffic from the roads.
Yeah, and that's one of the arguments they've made for this, and that they believe it's sort of like a win-win, being able to provide the service for free, but also, you know, removing some amount of traffic. Hard to say how much. And if you were in gridlock this summer on Nantucket, you might say, I didn't really notice that at all. But certainly, given the ridership climb that we've seen, you have to think that it did remove some number of vehicles from the road and the congestion around the island. So absolutely.
And NERTA has some electric buses that they're running as well now, too, right?
Yeah, that was another new thing this year that went into effect, was these new smaller electric buses that have been going around the island. Those have also been a big hit for folks, quieter, more nimble than some of the larger buses, and that's good for our small streets and cobblestone streets on Nantucket. So a revamped operation for the Regional Transit Authority here on Nantucket.
It's Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
A busy week on Beacon Hill, with state lawmakers taking another look at the Cannabis Control Commission and competing arguments over the proposed ballot question on tipped workers. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our Statehouse correspondent Katie Lannon about these issues. Here's their conversation.
Hey, Gilda. Good morning.
So a lot has happened with the Cannabis Control Commission this week. They picked a new director, and now lawmakers are talking about restructuring the commission. Why and what kinds of things do they want to change?
So this is all in the context of really more than a year now of internal personnel drama at the Cannabis Control Commission, starting when their chair was suspended last year over allegations of misconduct. She's since been fired. The agency's also been without a permanent executive director for a long time. And that kind of leadership dynamic really sparked calls on Beacon Hill for the legislature to get more involved. And the state inspector general, even at one point, recommended a state takeover, putting the marijuana agency into receivership. So it's been a long-running saga. And state lawmakers are now looking into where it might make sense for them to intervene, to tweak the law they wrote that set up the CCC. So that was the topic of a hearing at the State House this week, where they were exploring really issues, including the role of the chair versus the executive director, deep kind of wonky stuff, who's in charge of what and has what responsibilities, and whether it makes sense for the CCC to be independent or maybe come under the umbrella of another part of state government. Its five commissioners are appointed by the governor, the treasurer, and the attorney general. But those elected officials don't have oversight over what the agency does. And as you say, they'll soon have a new point person. If the salary and start date negotiations work out, the commission picked a new executive director this week who they hope will help start a new chapter at the agency and keep the work going, standing up the marijuana industry that's now several years in, but still has some growing pains. And that person is a former Cannabis Control Commission employee, David Lakeman. If the negotiations do go well, he'll be returning to Massachusetts from Illinois, where he leads the cannabis division at the Department of Agriculture there. Commissioners were impressed with his two-state experience regulating marijuana.
And we're just now 5 days away from Election Day, so I'd like to take this opportunity to provide some more clarity on one of the ballot questions. Question five, which would raise wages for tipped workers, has been met with opposition from some of the workers that this very question aims to help. Can you help us understand their arguments?
I can try. Ballot question season is always tough. And this is one that certainly I think folks might have been seeing. If you go out to eat, maybe you'll see signs at the restaurant or a note on the receipt when you pay the bill. This is about how any tipped workers, restaurant industry is the big one, get paid and who pays them. Currently, tipped workers can be paid a lower minimum wage by their employer so long as the tips bring them up to that full $15 an hour minimum wage. This question would gradually phase that out so that they earn the full minimum wage with tips on top. And the difference would really be who, whether it's the restaurant or the consumer, who pays the bulk of that paycheck, right? So the argument you've been hearing from a lot of the folks who oppose it has to do with the piece of the question that would allow businesses like restaurants to pool tips so that they're shared with non-tipped workers. But the supporters of the question really say that the tip structure and having to rely on tips leaves servers, bartenders, other tipped workers vulnerable to exploitation, sexual harassment, other types of mistreatment, that they're not necessarily guaranteed they're going to be paid the way they should be, even though it's required under state law that they earn at least $15 an hour. The opponents argue that the margins are so thin in the restaurant industry already that this could have really bigger economic ripple effects, a change of this nature.
All right, thank you. Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was CAI's Gilda Geis speaking with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We just heard CAI's Gilda Geis recorded earlier. Now she joins us live in person because that's how lucky we are. Hi, Gilda.
Hi, Steve.
Earlier this month, a book by a local Aquinnah Wampanoag tribal member on the history of colonization in the United States got moved from the nonfiction section of a Texas library to the fiction section. You spoke with the author. This is Linda Coombs. Tell us about the book that she wrote.
Yeah, so just for a little bit of context, Linda Coombs is a historian and museum curator and, of course, an author. And among her publications is this book we're talking about today, Colonization and the Wampanoag Story. It's written for a seventh grade reading level, but I've read some of it. Folks older than age 12 can certainly learn a thing or two from it. But yeah, Coombs was asked to write this book as part of a series called Race to the Truth, which tells stories of American history through the lens of historically marginalized groups. And Coombs' book talks about Wampanoag life before and during the colonial period and essentially seeks to correct the narrative around how this country was founded.
Mm. So what happened next in with the book is that a library in Texas decided to reshelf this into the section for fiction. And tell us what we know about what happened here.
Yes. So earlier this year, Montgomery County, Texas established this process where you can basically report a book for being controversial, so to speak, and a committee will review it. So they appointed this committee. The committee had total control over books that people reported, and it had been in place for months. It originally included five additional members, non-citizens, or still citizens, but they were librarians. But those librarian members were removed from the process of reviewing children's books. So basically someone, and we don't know who, it's anonymous, reported the book to that review committee, and the committee just decided to move the book to the fiction section.
Eventually the book was put back into nonfiction?
Yes. So some people were upset by the decision, including Debbie Reese, a Pueblo woman who runs a blog called American Indians in Children's Literature. When she caught wind of the situation from her readers, she got together with some other folks and they wrote a letter objecting to the committee's decision. Eventually, that got to the Montgomery County Commissioner's Court, and that court ordered the book returned to the nonfiction section and also put the entire book review committee on hold, nullifying all of its decisions from October 1st onward.
What did Linda Coombs tell you about what her perception was about this whole series of events?
Yeah, it's an interesting mix of feelings, as you might imagine. On the one hand, she wasn't surprised that people had tried to deny the history of the Wampanoag people because it happens to her all the time, not just to the Wampanoag, but also Indigenous people across what is now the United States. The history of English colonists' interactions with Native people can be brutal and disturbing, and it's not uncommon for non-Native folks to deny that. But then on the other hand, even though this reaction of denial is so common, it's still difficult for Coombs to wrap her mind around. She's baffled by people's willingness to basically ignore or rewrite history just because it's uncomfortable. Coombs basically says, the sooner we face our troubled past, the sooner we can resolve it.
I want to talk about another story that you covered this week. A local scientist from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution traveled to Cabo Verde, also called Cape Verde, as part of a scientific exchange. You interviewed him. Tell us about the program and what it was trying to accomplish.
Yeah, so that was Matt Charette. He also heads a PUI Sea Grant, and he was in Cabo Verde with other scientists, along with business owners and others. It was a delegation put together by the State Department to strengthen the relationship between the U.S. and the archipelago of Cabo Verde. From a scientific perspective, there's actually a lot that Cabo Verde and Cape Cod have to share. Both are blue economies, meaning that a lot of their commerce relies on the ocean, and so they both have a stake in conserving it. They both have issues with coastal erosion, marine debris, sustainable fisheries, and so this visit forged relationships between scientists in both places who may be able to work together and help each other.
What were some of his takeaways from the experience? What was it like for him to be over there and kind of thinking about science here and science there?
Yeah, so he had never been there before, but something he learned while he was there is that more Cabo Verdeans live abroad than in their home country. There's actually a lot of people might know or might not know there's a significant Cabo Verdean diaspora here in southeastern Massachusetts, which makes the partnership between the two all the more fitting. He also learned that while the total area of all 10 Cabo Verdean islands take up the same square mileage as Rhode Island, they're spread out in an area as large as Texas. Mm. So that is to say, the ocean is a really critical part of all aspects of Cabo Verdean life, kind of like here on Cape Cod.
Did you get like a whiff of what it was like in Cabo Verde talking to him?
Yeah, he really enjoyed learning about the culture and learning about how important the ocean is, not just to the economy and not just scientifically, but to culture, everyday life, basically.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times spoke with Catherine Shen of Connecticut Public. We heard from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current checked in with us. We heard from our Statehouse correspondent Katie Lannon and CAI's Gilda Geist. Big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. The news roundup is like toppling dominoes. We start one at the beginning and it just goes and goes, and Dan's hand is behind it all. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week. Thank you.